Welcome to the Materials Universe podcast, where we will explore the materials world and how it shapes our lives. My name is Bailey Tibbett, and I will be your host this season. Please join me as I interview researchers from the Center for Dynamics and Control of Materials at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Materials Universe podcast. I'm your host, Bailey Tibbett, and here with me is our manager.
Hi, guys. I'm Audrey Colgrove. Today, we are with Dr. Jose Alvarado from the Physics Department at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi.
Hey, y'all.
All right. So we wanted to start today by asking about your most recent work that's been looking into control theory. Would you mind giving us a little bit of an explanation of what control theory is?
Yeah. So as a physicist, I never learned anything about control theory. This is something that engineers learn when they're studying in college. Later in my career, when I started learning about control theory, I realized I saw it everywhere. So as a physicist, we are used to studying the laws of physics and how things move. But then when I watch, like, for example, a common problem in high school physics is if you throw a ball, you know, it follows a parabola and falls to the ground. But when I look at soccer, which is for me is a far more exciting physics problem, I see, of course, all the laws of physics there. I see the projectile motion, you know, I see the forces, energy, everything. But then I also see control theory. I see decisions being made. You know, I see not just parabolas, but all sorts of squiggly motions, you know, that not just the soccer players make that need to be decided in, you know, split second, rates in order to give us an exciting show. And ultimately, it all boils down to whether the ball makes it into the goal or not. So clearly, high school physics fails us to describe soccer. But as I've learned over the years, even the leading edge of physics still fails to describe soccer. And so for me, what I find very fascinating now, when I look all around me in biology, not just at soccer players, but even individual cells, I see that they're being controlled by signals. So humans are controlled by neurological signals. So our nerves zap our muscles and cause us to move. And also similarly, cells use phosphorylation of proteins and other kinds of mechanisms also to zap themselves and also to get themselves to move. So control theory for me is a wonderful extension of physics because it describes not just how things move, which is what physics describes, but also how signals, control signals, cause things to move.
Interesting. How do we see control theory play out in other aspects of like science? Do we see it in chemistry as well, for example?
Oh, gosh. in fact, I learned about control theory through chemical engineering textbooks initially that train chemical engineers to manage entire plants. So if you're in the, Bailey's nodding
her head. Process control.
Yeah, process control. This is like a senior level.
Yeah.
Interesting. As a physicist, you know, I approached these books and I didn't know anything about chemical plants. And so this is something that Bailey would definitely know a lot more about than I do. But my understanding is anyone who's seriously considering a chemistry career not just needs to understand reactions, but also how to make them happen. And if you have, you know, tanks of chemical A, B, and C, you can't just mix them all in and expect everything to go smoothly. You need to inject them at different rates, and you need to monitor the products of those rates. And, you know, if it's going too fast, then maybe you throttle a little bit of A and add more B. And that's control theory. Control theory is telling us how to navigate this landscape of multiple chemical reactions and multiple injection rates in order to get what we need, which is, you know, the product of the factory.
Interesting. So where do you see control theory impacting the research that your lab does?
The way I see it impacting our lab, the main question I ask is not just how are the laws of physics helpful in describing cells or organisms, humans, and their motion, but ultimately I want to understand how that motion is interplaying with all of the software that's going on in cells and organisms. So, you know, we learn as humans and cells also learn. You know, we store memories, we draw upon these memories, we make actions based off of these memories. But then at the same time, we're also observing the present. We're also changing and adapting to the present. And control theory for me is sort of the gateway that connects all of the laws of physics to all of the software processing and observation. And I think it gives us a new direction to start to integrate more holistically what's going on inside a human body.
Interesting.
Yeah. Are there any like biological systems or biomaterials that your research lately has been kind of focused in?
Oh, absolutely. So already now, since 20 years, I've been working with this protein called actin. And for a long time, I've been interested in how actin and other proteins that work with it are found in cells and in muscles to produce and generate forces. But then more recently in our lab, we've started really investigating and asking, how is it that control signals influence the way that these proteins can exert force? And so that's one example of work in our lab that's now moving towards a control theory direction where we're integrating signals together with the mechanics. But another direction in our lab has been with robotics. So I learned most of my control theory through playing around with very, very simple robots. And so we got robots now, and we've published some work on this, that mimic the way muscles generate force. Currently not to build a, you know, really amazing backflipping robot, but at least to better understand certain properties of muscle that are difficult to control in real muscle. So through these actin materials, as well as through robotics, I try to explore how signals and mechanics play together.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really cool. I think we definitely take a lot of aspects of control theory for granted, I feel like, when it comes to our biological systems, at least. Yeah, I also didn't really realize how ubiquitous it is until I took like process control. And I was like, but the P and ID structure can basically be applied to anything.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it was a good and bad realization a little bit. But yeah, that's really interesting. I think it'd be really cool to kind of see how exactly like biosignaling tends to go on and how processes move. And I think it has a really interesting incorporation too with your physics background, and I think you provide like a really unique perspective in terms of like the mechanics of it as well.
This is coming full circle for me. I have a physics background as well. And I remember meeting a professor in my undergrad who was working on game theory and was building soccer role-playing robots to investigate game theory. And I realized that they're different theories, but it's interesting how like they would probably interplay in that research a little bit.
Absolutely. And this is stuff that also excites me. Our lab isn't there yet, but I think control theory allows us to start taking all of this physics and moving it in a direction where it really interfaces with decisions. And when in exploring decision space, I mean, there's so many ways to make a decision. You know, control theory is a way of executing a decision, but to make the decision in the first place, you know, our brains, our central and peripheral nervous systems do it. You know, they take in a whole bunch of information from the environment, combine it with learned information, and use it to produce these control signals. So how does that happen? Neuroscientists are still scratching their heads. Cells do the same thing, except that now instead of having a whole bunch of neurons, they have a whole bunch of proteins that interact with each other in really complex ways, in ways that we just still cannot and probably may never describe with just equations. And then, of course, there are other ways of describing decisions, including game theory. And there's also decision theory that's out there. And, you know, now there's also machine learning, you know, where people are have been inspired by the way the brain works and arriving at these control signals and how those decision-making processes are made together with all of the physics. It's a fascinating question.
Interesting. I would love to sit here and talk to you about all of these theories for the rest of the day. But in order to keep this going, after talking to some of your grad students, they informed us that we should ask you what the thermodynamic meaning of life is.
The thermodynamic meaning.
Oh, I'm so excited for this.
Whoa. All right. All right. So I'm going to exclude anything that's not a thermodynamic meaning of life.
Okay.
Because for that, I think we can really only use poetry or art or, you know, human lived experience.
And we'll come back to that, I promise.
All right. Cool. All right. So then let's start with thermodynamic meaning of life. So if you really want to boil things down, and maybe it's too simple, cells and humans are just, you know, little bags of water that take in energy and burn it. And as long as we keep burning that energy, taking in Gibbs free energy in the form of fuel, in the form of the food that we eat, and we just keep generating entropy, and as long as that remains in balance, we're always hovering somewhere above thermal equilibrium. You know, for those that have not taken a thermodynamics class, thermodynamic equilibrium in a biological sense means death. A cell in thermodynamic equilibrium is not generating heat, is at the same temperature as the environment. It's cold, relatively speaking, and it's not alive anymore. But then, you know, in general, we humans, we're always a little bit above typical ambient temperatures. We're always burning heat. And that's one of the foundations of thermodynamic signature of life. Yes.
So if we're low on energy, we can say that we're just close to thermodynamic equilibrium, as the expression.
Thankfully, there are a lot of biochemical processes that encourage us to remain alive. The first is, in my case, being hangry. But then, of course, the body undergoes a whole bunch, in the absence of food, even there's even a whole bunch of other stuff where we start to metabolize, you know, our stored energy, which is in the form of fats. When we run out of that, then I think we start metabolizing our muscles and other proteins and things like that. So, you know, it can go on quite a while without food. But I definitely know how I feel when I'm low on energy, and it does feel like I'm very close to thermodynamic equilibrium.
Yeah, some days I'm closer than others.
Yeah, hopefully together we can all, you know, bring each other back.
But that's so beautiful because, like, I know that eating food isn't the meaning of life, but in order to continue being thermodynamically active, we need to continue taking in water, taking in food to generate heat and energy, which then down the line generates like work or art or research, et cetera.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I love that. That's so beautiful. It's very full circle to kind of go back, like think about your purpose on a cellular level and juxtapose it with your purpose in like an astronomical level in the world.
Yeah, if you want your place in this universe is to just generate a little bit more entropy.
We love entropy. I feel like this kind of reminds me a little bit of the conversation we were having with Dr. Wasserman, just in terms of like the human experience really needing to be a cumulative one. So you can't just, you know, just be focused on science, can't stagnate in one area, but to continue learning. And I know you have like a really diverse background in terms of like where you lived in places over the world, and has visiting these places like impacted how you act as a professor, how you look at research, anything like that?
Absolutely. I've been fortunate indeed to have been able to study abroad, you know, live in different places, learn different languages and cultures, have the opportunity to really embrace different ways of seeing humanity and the world. And I'm very glad that I get to bring all of that with me to my job here at UT, to use that position really to support all of us together as we do something really, really difficult, which is research, you know, or even also just studying undergrad, going through all of these courses. Like, we're all doing hard stuff here. Ultimately, I feel, you know, my biggest job is cheering us all on as, you know, as we like, you know, trudge through, and also encouraging people to follow their hearts, just like I did myself when I went around traveling. So,
do you think that attitudes towards like research or the thermodynamic meaning of life change across cultures?
I found more variability from room to room at a university than I have across the parts of the world that I was able to go to.
Interesting.
I think the environment, so I've really noticed how faculty members really create an environment around them. And everyone is unique. Every single person is unique. And every single person sees the world and sees the world of research in such a fundamentally different way. And no one method is right or wrong. You know, clearly we can all do, you know, our best to support everyone around us. But I've seen, I've seen some of the worst and I've seen some of the best everywhere.
I wonder, do you think that each lab kind of functions like its own organism in that sense, that they each have their own kind of drive and meaning that they're focusing on?
I can't imagine identical twins in the lab world. Yeah. Every, and even not just every researcher, but every team of researchers is also always undergoing change. When a new graduate student enters the group, they bring with them, you know, their own experience and their own attitudes and perspectives. And what I love most about my job is that I learn so much from my graduate students. So when they come in, they like, I just see how it benefits me and I see how it benefits the group already. So even my own lab, I can't say was ever the same. We're all just such unicorns.
Is there anything in particular that you do to try to cultivate that kind of organism, I guess, in lab?
One thing that I try to keep in mind, and it's one that that I always feel I never get right on the mark, and it's something that I'm always trying to develop, is sort of like, you know, open hand and pointed finger. You have to have both. You know, you have to give the lab the space to be able to roam and explore and try. And oftentimes I find the less I say, the more actually happens, because, you know, the moment I step in and I say, do this, it excludes everything else. And usually the graduate students know more than the PI about the specifics of a project and a direction and what would work and what wouldn't work. But then sometimes, indeed, I do need to step in. I do need to, you know, point a finger and say, you know, let's exclude everything else. Let's do this one thing. And, you know, finding that balance for me has always been really tough because I every situation that presents is also very different. And I just always have to keep thinking what the best way forward for us all would be.
Interesting. Yeah, for sure. I know. I mean, as a graduate student, I can definitely attest to getting stuck somewhere or, well, not getting stuck, but you sometimes, like, when you're doing research that's so, like, detailed and intricate, like, something goes wrong and you're like, I just need to know why. I just need to know why this goes wrong, even though it has nothing to do with furthering the research whatsoever. But you're like, this really cool thing happened. I'm sure it's nothing, but I must know. And so it's always good when, like, the PI can step in and be like, please go back to something else. Please look at something else. I know you really like this, but...
Yeah. And the thing is that this drive that we have, I've felt this too in my own PhD where like it just bugged me. I'm like, I need to keep going at it. Sometimes it did lead me astray. And, you know, thankfully, it's, you know, having a clear vision puts us on the right path. But then being able to take that itch and then channeling it to where it really needs to go, especially when the experiments you're trying to do are like, you know, you're getting different results every time. And like, you know, you're like, why is that? Then that's when you really, you know, that's the real itch where you really then start going and doing a lot of the heavy lifting. But yeah, knowing where to invest that energy is something that we all struggle with.
So how do you balance this kind of research mentor dynamic with the kind of social dynamics of the lab? We have heard that your lab goes on a retreat every year. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and the effects of that kind of connection that you build at the retreat on your lab?
Yeah. So first I need to credit my friend Danielle, who gave me this idea of doing a lab retreat. She and her lab, they go once a year out a cabin somewhere, and we've implemented that. So our retreat, and we've done it now 2 or 3 times, and we indeed just rent a, you know, space to spend a couple of nights. Last time we went out to Fredericksburg in Hill Country, and we do a mixture of, you know, social events, professional development events. And in past years, we've also been doing coding challenges to sort of improve our technical competencies. And what I really enjoy about these lab retreats is that they give us a good chunk of time to really think carefully about how can we improve the structure of our group? How can we learn about a specific topic? And these are all topics and ideas that come from mostly graduate students. So, you know, they'll propose sort of sessions from our retreat that we can do, and the needs will arise. So the structure of the retreat will change as the needs arise. So the last retreat, for example, a student in the lab wanted more expertise on how to build a website. In a previous one, a student said, hey, we are taking in undergraduate students, but we don't really have a good process for having a good structure for them and seeing them through. And so we formalized that. In the past, we've also had sessions on how to write an introduction for a paper and, you know, technically analyzing existing introductions and what works. So having the space to improve ourselves together with let's go out for a hike or grab ice cream or just sort of leave Austin for a little bit and surround ourselves in this beautiful nature, I think is a really great team building experience too.
Beautiful. To bring this back to the other side of the meaning of life question, we heard a rumor that your lab builds art together on these retreats. How does the chance to work on art together impact your students as collaborators and as teammates?
Well, I should let the students speak for themselves because I don't know what their experience was, but I thought we had a lot of fun. Indeed, we had a session where we generated art. One was like, you know, science-based, whatever you thought, and the other one was just freestyle. We just took some cheap plywood and some cans of spray paint and, you know, went off at it. The product of those artworks are hanging in our labs, which I think is really cool. So not only was it a fond memory that I had of us all spray painting this plywood together and, you know, just expressing ourselves, but having it there as a backdrop in our labs, to me, is just very heartwarming. So, hopefully the students also agree with me, but I think indeed we can all cherish that.
I think it sounds like a beautiful reminder to keep the creativity in your research as well, that it's not just about the process.
Yes, you need both creativity and technical precision and shrewdness. But if you want to open new inquiry, It's hard to do that when you're focused on following an instruction manual.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think having art that, I guess having art that I design in the lab would be pretty cool just to break up the monotony of, of the benches and the chemicals. I think at the very least, they probably appreciate that, hopefully.
Yes, so my own office is also, I have this giant corkboard. It's got a piece of art that I made with a group of friends. It's got a whole bunch of like thank you cards from like students and people from the past. You know, it gives me a lot of inspiration, especially on my roughest days when I look at that wall. And, you know, just having these like personal mementos, you know, just helps at least me move forward for sure.
Well, and you have such a strong connection to the arts because we know that you've previously said that if you weren't doing science, you'd go back to graphic design.
Yes.
Have you seen any overlap in those two fields?
100%, for sure. For me, graphic design was always not just about aesthetics, but also about communication. And I've realized how much that has helped me in communicating my work through my publications, and now very critically through the proposals that I write. So when I'm begging for money, I have to make my idea 100% crystal clear, which is hard to do because you don't have data, you don't have the results to work with. All you have is an idea. And to convince an organization to give you hundreds of thousands of dollars based off of this idea, it's very easy to sort of get lost in detail and to express this idea very clearly. It's important to write clearly. And I believe it's also important to visually communicate those ideas very clearly. And so my experience having worked as a graphic designer means that I can, you know, just sort of roll up my sleeves, you know, go in there on Adobe Illustrator and just keep iterating until this visual element expresses exactly what I have in mind, which is also what I write about.
What do you miss the most about graphic design?
I don't, because I keep it with me.
Yeah.
I feel like my job is still graphic design plus all this other stuff.
Yeah, I agree. Some papers definitely need a graphic designer.
But of course, you know, everyone's got their strengths and weaknesses. You know, I also try to have compassion, you know, for us all.
No, I think that's really interesting, having like graphic design interplay with aesthetics. I think sometimes in science, aesthetics are a little undervalued, but they really go a long way. Even just looking at graphs sometimes. This is definitely tangential, though.
Well, no, I mean, so here's also another thing that I've noticed in the world of research. There's this inherent struggle where we researchers, especially those coming from quantitative fields, we think, all right, you know, we've got quantitative, you know, math, numbers-based approach, rational, logical, and we're going to use this and apply this to the reality that we observe. This has really gotten us very far and has really done a lot of, you know, good, also some harm, but it's also done a lot of good and really improved humans' quality of life, I believe. And I truly believe that it can continue to do so. But when we rational thinking, quantitative thinking people approach research and think, oh, you know, all we have to do is just be as precise and quantitative as possible, we then get frustrated when we realize that the world of research still has a lot of qualitative, you know, human emotional stuff attached to it. Our work, our scientific work, our quantitative scientific work is up for a very emotional, a very qualitative, and maybe sometimes crabby reviewer. And then, of course, you know, when we go out to conferences, the way our work is perceived is not just judged on a quantitative level, but there are a lot of unspoken, emotional, qualitative things that affect also how our research is viewed. We quantitative people cannot escape the reality of us just being bags of emotion. So I feel that when at the best moments of my work, when I'm tapping into that essence of aesthetics, where, you know, things are just clear and to me beautiful and just I've gotten really to the bottom of something. And if I can really strike at that idea and make sense of it and then explain it to others using graphical methods and show people the beauty of what I understand, that to me is very powerful. And I think it's, you know, one of those cases where the, you know, emotional and the rational really align very nicely.
I think it's really beautiful. This is sort of a theme that we've been exploring on this season of the podcast, of the like human impact that, it, you know, that our work has, you know, like all of the research we do is out there, going to go out there eventually and impact the world as we know it in some way, shape, or form. And a big part of like my role here at the MRSEC is communicating to our graduate students and our undergraduate students how they need to start learning to communicate their research in the human side of things, not just the quantitative side of things. Do you have any like methods you use for talking to your graduate students about trying to convey the human side of their research?
One thing that I learned, and this was back in college when I was doing improvisation theater that in German, that was really hard.
Wow. Yeah.
Try to be funny to an audience of Germans. I managed that together with many others. half of us were foreigners. We did it. But I learned in improvisation theater how to write a Hollywood story. And I thought, all right, cool. This is something that only applies to improv or only applies to, you know, making a movie or something. But over the years, as I started doing research and I started looking at research papers more carefully, in research, we're also always constructing narratives. We're also making Hollywood movies. There's always still sort of like a routine, you know, where this is how the research world has always looked. And then here's a conflict. There's a research question that's really bugging us. Here we are, the heroes of the day that, you know, here we show that. And then here are our results. And now we've changed the research world. That just sounded like a Hollywood movie because it more or less is. And so we've been telling stories as humans for generations. Our ancestors told stories that we still tell each other today. It's one of the ways that we're just process information. And in fact, in a way, stories themselves live longer than we humans do. And we are just the vessels through which these stories pass, if you want to look at it from a different perspective. So one way of expressing what you've understood in the world of research more clearly is to harmonize with this Hollywood recipe that we've been using for millennia of, you know, telling each other how we learn and how we communicate. So there's a lot to be learned from researchers in the arts and, you know, Hollywood movies, script writing, and many, many other fields. Yeah.
This might be a hard question, but I guess kind of going back to your lab's research specifically a little bit, is there anything in particular that you hope your research is communicating to the rest of the world?
Well, the short-term answer is we have so much to learn about how decisions, signals, information, and the bread and butter physics all work together as an integrated whole. In a very complicated way, to give something as seemingly simple as here's Lionel Messi shooting a goal. There's so much underneath there, and we're so far away from understanding it. So what I hope our lab can communicate to the rest of the world is that this is a very exciting problem to work on. There's going to be a lot of progress that needs to be made, and that hopefully we can all keep chipping away a little bit at it.
That's beautiful. So that leads us to the question that has been the through line of our season, because at our core, we're a material science podcast. And so we were wondering if there was any material science research that's happening right now that you think will be like very important or impactful in the next decade.
Definitely. So I'm relatively new to the proper material science field, because when I look at a lot of material science programs, there are a lot of material science dates all the way to melting metals and things like that. And when I look at current material science programs, I see a lot of things that I've never myself in my research worked with. But I have worked with systems called active matter. These are systems that physicists have been interested in for maybe the past couple of decades. And I think one of the exciting turns that the materials world is and has been undergoing is not just understanding how a material, which you can think of as just like a thing that's over there, and then, you know, a force that's somewhere over here, and how the two play around with each other, but now how can a material with forces inside of it deform itself and shape itself? This is what we do in biology all the time. And that's what makes, for me, active matter so exciting, is it becomes a problem of materials shaping themselves. So for me, that's an exciting direction moving forward.
Oh, wow. Is that like right out of science fiction almost? Like these materials that can build themselves into their own structures?
Yeah, yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that same level of wonder I get whenever I see a developmental biologist showing movies of a single cell, you know, doubling to 2, 4, 8, 16 cells, and it doesn't stay a ball of cells forever. It sculpts itself, you know, changes its shape at the cellular level, at the tissue level, and it's truly a miracle. And it continues to scratch, make our head scratch. Yeah,
we are miraculous sacks of water.
Miraculous sacks of water.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here on the Materials Universe, Dr. Alvarado.
Yes. Thank you very much, Audrey. Thank you very much, Bailey.
That's all for today's episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Thank you for listening to our interesting conversations with inspiring guests from different fields of science and engineering. We hope you enjoyed learning something new. Please leave us a review and share this podcast with friends. You can follow us on social media at TexasCDCM on Instagram and X. Thank you to the National Science Foundation and the University of Texas at Austin. And an additional thank you to the Late's Audio Studio crew for their help with the production of this podcast.